Chapter 8. I opened Alicia's file on my desk. Diomedes had volunteered it. "You must read my notes," he said. "They will help you." I had no desire to wade through his notes. I already knew what Diomedes thought. I needed to find out what I thought. But nonetheless, I accepted it politely. "Thank you, that will be such a help." My office was small and sparsely furnished, tucked away at the back of the building by the fire escape. I looked out of the window. A little blackbird was pecking at a patch of frozen grass on the ground outside, dispiritedly and without much hope. I shivered. The room was freezing. The small radiator under the window was broken. Yuri said he'd try and get it fixed, but that my best bet was to talk to Stephanie, or, failing that, bring it up in community. I felt a sudden pang of empathy with Elif and her battle to get the broken pool cue replaced. I looked through Alicia's file without much expectation. The majority of the information I needed was on the online database. Diomedes, however, like a lot of older staff members, preferred to write his reports by hand and, ignoring Stephanie's nagging requests to the contrary, continued to do so, hence the dog-eared file in front of me. I flicked through Diomedes' notes, ignoring his somewhat old-fashioned psychoanalytic interpretations, and focused on the nurse's daily handover reports that kept an account of Alicia's day-to-day behaviour. I read through those reports carefully. I wanted facts, figures, details. I needed to know exactly what I was getting into, what I'd have to deal with, and if there were any surprises in store. In the end, the file revealed very little. When she was first admitted, Alicia slashed her wrists twice and self-harmed with whatever she could get her hands on. She was kept on two-on-one observation for the first 6 months, meaning two nurses watched over her at all times, which was eventually relaxed to one-on-one. Alicia made no effort to interact with patients or staff, remaining withdrawn and isolated, and, for the most part, the other patients had left her alone. If someone doesn't reply when you speak to them and never initiates conversation, you soon forget they're there. Alicia had quickly melted into the background, becoming invisible. Only one incident stood out. It took place in the canteen, a few weeks after Alicia's admission. Elif accused Alicia of taking her seat. It was unclear exactly what had happened, but the confrontation escalated rapidly. Apparently, Alicia became violent. She smashed a plate and tried to slash Elif's throat with the jagged edge. She had to be restrained, sedated, and placed in isolation. I wasn't sure why this incident drew my attention, but it didn't feel right to me. I decided to approach Elif and ask her about it. I tore off a sheet of paper from a pad and reached for my pen, an old habit formed at university. Something about the process of putting pen to paper helps me organize my mind. I've always had difficulty formulating an opinion until I've written it down. I began scribbling ideas, notes, goals, devising a plan of attack. In order to help Alicia, I needed to understand her and her relationship with Gabriel. Did she love him? Hate him? And why had she refused to speak about the murder or anything else? No answers, not yet. Just questions. I wrote down a word and underlined it. Alcestis. The self-portrait. It was important, somehow, I knew that. And understanding why would be central to unlocking this mystery. This painting was Alicia's sole communication, her only testimony. And it was saying something I had yet to comprehend. I made a note to revisit the gallery to look at the painting again. I wrote down another word, childhood. If I were to make sense of Gabriel's murder, I needed to understand not only the events of the night Alicia killed him, but also the events of the distant past. The seeds of what happened in those few minutes when she shot her husband were probably sown years earlier. Murderous rage, homicidal rage, is not born in the present. It originates in the land before memory, in the world of early childhood, with abuse and mistreatment at a young age, which builds up a charge over the years until it explodes, often at the wrong target. I needed to find out how her childhood had shaped her, and if Alicia couldn't or wouldn't tell me, I had to find someone who would, someone who knew Alicia before the murder, who could help me understand her history, who she was, and how she ended up this way. In the file, Alicia's next of kin was listed as her aunt, Lydia Rose, who brought her up following the death of Alicia's mother in a car accident. Alicia had also been in the car crash, but survived. That trauma must have affected the little girl profoundly. I hoped Lydia would be able to tell me about it. The only other contact was Alicia's solicitor, Max Berenson. Max was Gabriel Berenson's brother. As such, he was perfectly placed to observe their marriage on an intimate basis. Whether or not Max Berenson would confide in me was another matter. An unsolicited approach to Alicia's family by her psychotherapist was unorthodox, to say the least. I had a dim feeling Diomedes would not approve. Better not ask his permission, I decided, in case he refused. Looking back, this was my first professional transgression in dealing with Alicia, setting an unfortunate precedent for what followed. I should have stopped there. But even then, it was too late to stop. In many ways, my fate was already decided, like in a Greek tragedy. I reached for the phone. I called Max Berenson at his office, using the contact number listed in Alicia's file. It rang several times before it was answered. "The offices of Elliot, Barrow and Berenson," said a receptionist with a bad cold. "Mr. Berenson, please. May I ask who's calling?" "My name is Theo Faber. I'm a psychotherapist at the Grove. I was wondering if it might be possible to have a word with Mr. Berenson about his sister-in-law." There was a slight pause before she responded. "Oh, I see. Well, Mr. Berenson is out of the office for the rest of the week. He's in Edinburgh visiting a client. If you leave your number, I'll have him call you on his return." I gave her my number and hung up. I dialed the next number in the file, Alicia's aunt, Lydia Rose. This time it was answered on the first ring. An elderly woman's voice sounded breathless and rather annoyed.
"Yes? What is it?"
"Is that Mrs. Rose?"
"Who are you?"
"I'm calling regarding your niece, Alicia Berenson. I'm a psychotherapist working at the..."
"Fuck off,"
she said, and hung up. I frowned to myself. Not a good start. Chapter 9. I desperately needed a cigarette. As I left the Grove, I looked for them in my coat pockets, but they weren't there. "Looking for something?" I turned round. Yuri was standing right behind me. I hadn't heard him, and I was a little startled to find him so close. "I found them in the nurse's station," he said, grinning, handing me a pack of cigarettes. "Must have fallen out of your pocket." "Thanks." I took them and lit one. I offered him the packet. Yuri shook his head. "I don't smoke. Not cigarettes, anyway," he laughed. "You look like you need a drink. Come on, I'll buy you a pint." I hesitated. My instinct was to refuse. I had never been one for socializing with work colleagues, and I doubted Yuri and I had much in common, but he probably knew Alicia better than anyone at the Grove, and his insights might prove useful. "Sure," I said, "why not?" We went to a pub near the station, the Slaughtered Lamb, dark and dingy. It had seen better days. So had the old men dozing over their half-finished pints. Yuri got us a couple of beers, and we sat at a table at the back. Yuri took a long swig of beer and wiped his mouth. "Well," he said, "tell me about Alicia." "Alicia? How did you find her?" "I'm not sure I did find her." Yuri gave me a quizzical look, then smiled. "She doesn't want to be found. Yeah, it's true, she's hiding." "You're close to her, I can see that." "I take special care of her. No one knows her like I do, not even Professor Diomedes." There was a boastful note to his voice. It annoyed me for some reason. I wondered how well he really knew her, or if he were just bragging. "What do you make of her silence? What do you think it means?" Yuri shrugged.
"I guess it means she's not ready to talk. She'll talk when she's ready."
"Ready for what?"
"Ready for the truth, my friend."
"And what is that?" Yuri cocked his head to one side slightly, studying me. and the question that came out of his mouth surprised me. Are you married, Theo? I nodded. I am, yes.
Yeah, I thought so. I was married once too. We moved here from Latvia. But she didn't fit in like I did. She didn't make an effort, you know? She didn't learn English. Anyway, I wasn't happy. But I was in denial, lying to myself.
He drained his drink and completed his sentence.
Until I fell in love.
Presumably you don't mean with your wife. Yuri laughed and shook his head.
No, a woman who lived near me, a very beautiful woman. It was love at first sight. I saw her on the street. It took me a long time to get the courage to talk to her. I used to follow her. I'd watch her sometimes without her knowing. I'd stand outside her house and look, hoping she would appear at the window.
He laughed. The story was starting to make me feel uncomfortable. I finished my beer and glanced at my watch, hoping Yuri would take the hint, but he didn't.
One day, he said, I tried speaking to her, but she wasn't interested in me. I tried a few times, but she told me to stop pestering her.
I didn't blame her, I thought. I was about to make my excuses, but Yuri kept talking.
It was very hard to accept, he said. I was sure we were meant to be together. She broke my heart. I got very angry with her, very mad.
And what happened? I asked, curious despite myself.
Nothing.
Nothing? You stayed with your wife? Yuri shook his head.
No, it was over with her, but it took falling for this woman for me to admit it, to face the truth about me and my wife. Sometimes it takes courage, you know? And a long time, to be honest.
I see. And you think Alicia's not ready to face the truth about her marriage, is that what you're saying? You may well be right. Yuri shrugged.
And now I'm engaged to a nice girl from Hungary. She works in a spa, she speaks good English, we're a good match, we have a good time.
I nodded and checked my watch again. I picked up my coat. I have to go, I'm late to meet my wife.
Okay, no problem. What's her name? Your wife?
For some reason I didn't want to tell him. I didn't want Yuri to know anything about her.
But that was stupid.
Catherine, I said. Her name is Catherine, but I call her Kathy. Yuri gave me an odd smile.
Let me give you some advice, he said. Go home to your wife. Go home to Kathy, who loves you, and leave Alicia behind.
Chapter 10. I went to meet Kathy at the National Theatre Cafe on the South Bank, where the performers would often congregate after rehearsal. She was sitting at the back of the cafe with a couple of fellow actresses, deep in conversation. They looked up at me as I approached.
Are your ears burning, darling?
Kathy said as she kissed me. Why, should they be? I'm telling the girls all about you.
Ah, should I leave?
Don't be silly, sit down. It's perfect timing. I've just got to how we met. I sat down and Kathy continued her story. It was a story she enjoyed telling. She occasionally glanced in my direction and smiled as if to include me, but it was a perfunctory gesture, for this was her tale, not mine. I was sitting at a bar when he finally showed up. At last, when I'd given up hope of ever finding him, in he walked, the man of my dreams, better late than never. I thought I was going to be married by the time I was 25, you know? By 30, I was going to have two kids, small dog, big mortgage, but here I was, 33-ish, and things hadn't quite gone to plan. Kathy said this with an arch smile and winked at the girls. Anyway, I was seeing this Australian guy called Daniel, but he didn't want to get married or have kids anytime soon, so I knew I was wasting my time. And we were out one night when suddenly it happened. Mr. Wright walked in. Kathy looked at me and smiled and rolled her eyes. With his girlfriend. This part of the story needed careful handling in order to retain her audience's sympathy. The truth is, Kathy and I were both dating other people when we met. Double infidelity isn't the most attractive or auspicious start to a relationship, particularly as we were introduced to each other by our then partners. There was some reason they knew each other, I can't remember the precise details. Marianne had once gone out with Daniel's flatmate, possibly, or the other way round. I don't remember exactly how we were introduced, but I do remember the first moment I saw Kathy. It was like an electric shock. I remember her long black hair, piercing green eyes, her mouth. She was beautiful, exquisite, an angel. At this point in telling the tale, Kathy paused and smiled and reached for my hand. Remember, Theo, how we got talking? You said you were training to be a shrink and I said I was nuts, so it was a match made in heaven? This got a big laugh from the girls. Kathy laughed too and glanced at me sincerely, anxiously, her eyes searching mine. No, but darling, seriously, it was love at first sight, wasn't it? This was my cue. I nodded and kissed her cheek. Of course it was, true love. This received a look of approval from her friends, but I wasn't performing. She was right. It was love at first sight. Well, lust, anyway. Even though I was with Marianne that night, I couldn't keep my eyes off Kathy. I watched her from a distance, talking animatedly to Daniel, and then I saw her lips mouth, "Fuck you." They were arguing. It looked heated. Daniel turned and walked out.
You're being quiet, said Marianne. What's wrong?
Nothing. Let's go home then. I'm tired.
Not yet, I said, only half listening. Let's have another drink.
I want to go now.
Then go.
Marianne shot me a hurt look, then grabbed her jacket and walked out. I knew there'd be a row the next day, but I didn't care. I made my way over to Kathy at the bar. Is Daniel coming back? I asked.
No, Kathy said. How about Marianne?
I shook my head.
No.
Would you like another drink?
Yes, I would.
So we ordered two more drinks. We stood at the bar, talking. We discussed my psychotherapy training, I remember, and Kathy told me about her stint at drama school. She didn't stay long, as she signed up with an agent at the end of her first year and had been acting professionally ever since. I imagined, without knowing why, that she was probably rather a good actress.
Studying wasn't for me, she said. I wanted to get out there and do it, you know?
Do what? Act?
No, live.
Kathy tilted her head, looking out from under her dark lashes, her emerald green eyes peering at me mischievously.
So, Theo, how do you have the patience to keep doing it? Studying, I mean.
Maybe I don't want to get out there and live. Maybe I'm a coward. No, if you were a coward, you'd have gone home with your girlfriend. Kathy laughed. It was a surprisingly wicked laugh. I wanted to grab her and kiss her hard. I'd never experienced such overwhelming physical desire before. I wanted to pull her close, feel her lips and the heat of her body against mine.
I'm sorry, she said. I shouldn't have said that. I always say whatever pops into my head. I told you, I'm a bit nuts.
Kathy did that a lot, protesting her insanity. I'm crazy, I'm nuts, I'm insane. But I never believed her. She laughed too easily and too often for me to believe she ever suffered the kind of darkness I had experienced. She had a spontaneity about her, a lightness. She took a delight in living and was endlessly amused by life. Despite her protestations, she seemed the least crazy person I'd ever known. Around her, I felt more sane. Kathy was American. She was born and brought up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Her English mother gave Kathy dual citizenship, but Kathy didn't seem even remotely English. She was determinedly, distinctly un-English, not just in the way she spoke, but in the way she saw the world and how she approached it. Such confidence, such exuberance. I'd never met anyone like her before. We left the bar, hailed a cab, and gave the address of my flat. We rode the short journey in silence. When we arrived, she gently pressed her lips to mine. I broke through my reserve and pulled her towards me. We kept kissing as I fumbled with the key to the front door. We were scarcely inside before we were undressing, stumbling into the bedroom, falling onto the bed. That night was the most erotic, blissful night of my life. I spent hours exploring Kathy's body.
We made love all night until dawn. I remember there was so much white everywhere, white sunlight creeping around the edges of the curtains, white walls, white bedsheets, the whites of her eyes, her teeth, her skin. I never knew that skin could be so luminous, so translucent, ivory white with occasional blue veins visible just beneath the surface, like threads of colour in white marble. She was a statue, a Greek goddess come to life in my hands. We lay there, wrapped in each other's arms. Kathy was facing me, her eyes so close they were out of focus. I gazed into a hazy green sea.
Well, she said.
Well, what about Marianne?
Marianne?
A flicker of a smile.
Your girlfriend?
Oh, yes, yes. I hesitated, unsure.
I don't know about Marianne.
And Daniel? Kathy rolled her eyes. Forget Daniel, I have.
Have you really?
Kathy's response was to kiss me. Before Kathy left, she took a shower. While she was showering, I phoned Marianne. I wanted to arrange to see her, to tell her face to face, but she was annoyed and insisted we have it out then and there on the phone. Marianne wasn't expecting me to break up with her, but that's what I did, as gently as I could. She started crying and became upset and angry. I ended up hanging up on her. Brutal, yes, and unkind. I'm not proud of that phone call. But at the time, it seemed like the only honest action to take. I still don't know what I could have done differently. On our first proper date, Kathy and I met at Kew Gardens. It was her idea. She was astonished I'd never been.
You're kidding, she said.
You've never gone to the greenhouses. There's this big one with all the tropical orchids, and they keep it so hot, it's like an oven. When I was at drama school, I used to go and hang out there just to warm up. How about we meet there after you finish work? Then she hesitated, suddenly unsure. Or is it too far for you to go?
I'd go further than Kew Gardens for you, darling, I said.
Idiot, she said, and kissed me. Kathy was waiting at the entrance when I arrived, in her enormous coat and scarf, waving like an excited child.
Come on, come on, she said. Follow me.
She led me through the frozen mud to the big glass structure that housed the tropical plants and pushed open the door and charged inside. I followed her and was immediately struck by the sudden rise in temperature, an onslaught of heat. I tore off my scarf and coat. Kathy smiled.
See, I told you, it's like a sauna. Ain't it great?
We walked around along the paths, carrying our coats, holding hands, looking at the exotic flowers. I felt an unfamiliar happiness just being in her company, as though a secret door had been opened and Kathy had beckoned me across the threshold into a magical world of warmth and light and colour and hundreds of orchids in a dazzling confetti of blues and reds and yellows. I could feel myself thawing in the heat, softening around the edges, like a tortoise emerging into the sun after a long winter's sleep, blinking and waking up. Kathy did that for me. She was my invitation to life, one I grasped at with both hands. So this was it, I remember thinking. This was love. I recognized it without question, and it was clear to me that I'd never experienced anything like this before. My previous romantic encounters had been brief, unsatisfactory for all concerned. As a student, I had summoned up the nerve, aided by a considerable amount of alcohol, to lose my virginity to a Canadian sociology student called Meredith, who wore sharp metal braces that cut into my lips as we kissed. There followed a string of uninspired relationships. I never seemed to find the special connection I longed for. I had believed I was too damaged, too incapable of intimacy. But now, every time I heard Kathy's contagious giggle, a wave of excitement ran through me. Through a kind of osmosis, I absorbed her youthful exuberance, her unself-consciousness and joy. I said yes to her every suggestion and every whim.
I didn't recognize myself. I liked this new person, this unafraid man Kathy inspired me to be. We fucked all the time. I was consumed with lust, perpetually, urgently hungry for her. I needed to keep touching her. I couldn't get close enough. Kathy moved in with me that December into my one-bedroom apartment in Kentish Town. It was a dank, thickly carpeted basement flat, windows but with no view. Our first Christmas together, we were determined to do it properly. We bought a tree from a stall by the tube station and dressed it with a jumble of decorations and lights from the market. I remember vividly the scent of pine needles and wood and candles burning, and Kathy's eyes staring into mine, sparkling, twinkling like the lights on the tree. I spoke without thinking. The words just came out. "Will you marry me?" Kathy stared at me. "What? I love you, Kathy. Will you marry me?" Kathy laughed. And then, to my joy and amazement, she said, "Yes." The next day we went out and she chose a ring, and the reality of the situation dawned on me. We were engaged. Bizarrely, the first people I thought of were my parents. I wanted to introduce Kathy to them. I wanted them to see how happy I was, that I had finally escaped, that I was free. So we got the train to Surrey. In hindsight, it was a bad idea, doomed from the start. My father greeted me with typical hostility. "You look terrible, Theo. You're too thin. Your hair is too short. You look like a convict." "Thanks, Dad. Good to see you too." My mother seemed more depressed than usual, quieter, smaller somehow, like she wasn't really there. Dad was a heavier presence, unfriendly, glaring, unsmiling. He didn't take his cold, dark eyes off Kathy the entire time. It was an uncomfortable lunch. They didn't seem to like her, nor did they seem particularly happy for us. I don't know why I was surprised. After lunch, my father disappeared into his study. He didn't emerge again. When my mother said goodbye, she held on to me for too long, too closely, and was unsteady on her feet. I felt desperately sad. When Kathy and I left the house, part of me hadn't left, I knew, but had remained behind, forever a child, trapped. I felt lost, hopeless, close to tears. And then Kathy surprised me, as always. She threw her arms around me, pulling me into a hug. "I understand now," she whispered in my ear. "I understand it all. I love you so much more now." She didn't explain further. She didn't need to. We were married in April in a small registry office off Euston Square. No parents invited, and no God. Nothing religious at Kathy's insistence. But I said a secret prayer during the ceremony. I silently thanked him for giving me such unexpected, undeserved happiness. I saw things clearly now. I understood his greater purpose. God hadn't abandoned me during my childhood when I had felt so alone and scared. He had been keeping Kathy hidden up his sleeve, waiting to produce her like a deft magician. I felt such humility and gratitude for every second we spent together. I was aware how lucky, how incredibly fortunate I was to have such love, how rare it was, and how others weren't so lucky. Most of my patients weren't loved. Alicia Berenson wasn't. It's hard to imagine two more different women than Kathy or Alicia. Kathy makes me think of light, warmth, colour and laughter. When I think of Alicia, I think only of depth, of darkness, of sadness, of silence. Part 2. Unexpressed emotions will never die. They are buried alive and will come forth later in uglier ways. Sigmund Freud.
Chapter 1. Alicia Berenson's Diary. 16th of July. I never thought I'd be longing for rain. We're into our fourth week of the heatwave and it feels like an endurance test. Each day seems hotter than the last. It doesn't feel like England, more like a foreign country, Greece or somewhere. I'm writing this on Hampstead Heath. The whole park is strewn with red-faced, semi-naked bodies, like a beach or a battlefield, on blankets or benches or spread out on the grass. I'm sitting under a tree, in the shade. It's 6 o'clock, and it's started to cool down. The sun is low and red in a golden sky. The heath looks different in this light. Darker shadows, brighter colours. The grass looks like it's on fire, flickering flames under my feet. I took off my shoes on my way here and walked barefoot. It reminded me of when I was little and I'd play outside. It reminded me of another summer, hot like this one. The summer Mum died. Playing outside with Paul, cycling on our bike through golden fields dotted with wild daisies, exploring abandoned houses and haunted orchards. In my memory, that summer lasts forever. I remember Mum and those colourful tops she'd wear with the yellow stringy straps. So flimsy and delicate, just like her. She was so thin, like a little bird. She would put on the radio and pick me up and dance me around to pop songs. I remember how she smelled of shampoo and cigarettes and Nivea hand cream, always with an undertone of vodka. How old was she then? 28, 29? She was younger than I am now. That's an odd thought. On my way here, I saw a small bird on the path, lying by the roots of a tree. I thought it must have fallen from its nest. It wasn't moving, and I wondered if it had broken its wings. I stroked its head gently with my finger. It didn't react. I nudged it and turned it over, and the underside of the bird was gone, eaten away, leaving a cavity filled with maggots, fat, white, slippery maggots twisting, turning. Writhing, I felt my stomach turn. I thought I was going to be sick. It was so foul, so disgusting. Deathly. I can't get it out of my mind. 17th of July. I've started taking refuge from the heat in an air-conditioned cafe on the high street, Café de l'Artista. It's icy cold inside, like climbing into a fridge. There's a table I like by the window where I sit drinking iced coffee. Sometimes I read or sketch or make notes. Mostly I just let my mind drift, luxuriating in the coldness. The beautiful girl behind the counter stands there looking bored, staring at her phone, checking her watch, and sighing periodically. Yesterday afternoon her sighs seemed especially long, and I realised she was waiting for me to go so she could close up. I left, reluctantly. Walking in this heat feels like wading through mud. I feel worn down, battered, beaten up by it. We're not equipped for it, not in this country. Gabriel and I don't have air conditioning at home. Who does? But without it, it's impossible to sleep. At night, we throw off the covers and lie there in the dark, naked, drenched in sweat. We leave the windows open, but there's no hint of a breeze, just hot, dead air. I bought an electric fan yesterday. I set it up at the foot of the bed on top of the chest and Gabriel immediately started complaining. It makes too much noise, we'll never sleep. We can't sleep anyway, I said. At least we won't be lying here in a sauna. Gabriel grumbled, but in the end he fell asleep before I did. I lay there listening to the fan. I like the sound it makes, a gentle whirring. I can shut my eyes and tune into it and disappear. I've been carrying the fan around the house with me, plugging and unplugging it as I move around. This afternoon I took it down to the studio at the end of the garden. Having the fan made it just about bearable, but it's still too hot to get much work done. I'm falling behind, but too hot to care. I did have a bit of a breakthrough. I finally understood what's wrong with the Jesus picture. Why it's not working. The problem isn't with the composition, Jesus on the cross. The problem is, it's not a picture of Jesus at all. Doesn't even look like him, whatever he looked like, because it's not Jesus. It's Gabriel. Incredible that I didn't see it before. Somehow, without intending to, I've put Gabriel up there instead. It's his face I've painted, his body. Isn't that insane? So I must surrender to that and do what the painting demands of me. I know now that when I have an agenda for a picture, a predetermined idea how it should turn out, it never works. It remains stillborn, lifeless. But if I'm really paying attention, really aware, I sometimes hear a whispering voice pointing me in the right direction, and if I give in to it, as an act of faith, it leads me somewhere unexpected. Not where I intended, but somewhere intensely alive, glorious, and the result is independent of me, with a life force of its own. I suppose what scares me is giving in to the unknown. I like to know where I'm going. That's why I always make so many sketches, trying to control the outcome. No wonder nothing comes to life, because I'm not really responding to what's going on in front of me. I need to open my eyes and look and be aware of life as it is happening and not simply how I want it to be. Now I know it's a portrait of Gabriel. I can go back to it. I can start again. I'll ask him to pose for me. He hasn't sat for me in a long time. I hope he likes the idea and doesn't think it's sacrilegious or anything. He can be funny like that sometimes. 18th of July. I walked down the hill to Camden Market this morning. I've not been there in years, not since Gabriel and I went together one afternoon in search of his lost youth. He used to go when he was a teenager, when he and his friends had been up all night, dancing, drinking, talking. They'd turn up at the market in the early morning and watch the traders set up their stalls and try and score some grass from the Rastafarian dealers hanging out on the bridge by Camden Lock. The dealers were no longer there when Gabriel and I went, to Gabriel's dismay. I don't recognise it here anymore, he said. It's a sanitised tourist trap. Walking around today, I wondered if the problem wasn't so much that the market had changed as the fact that Gabriel had changed. It's still populated by 16-year-olds, embracing the sunshine, sprawled on either side of the canal, a jumble of bodies, boys in rolled-up shorts with bare chests, girls in bikinis or bras, skin everywhere, burning, reddening, flesh. The sexual energy was palpable, their hungry, impatient thirst for life. I felt a sudden desire for Gabriel, for his body and his strong legs, his thick thighs laying over mine. When we have sex, I always feel an insatiable hunger for him, for a kind of union between us, something that's bigger than me, bigger than us, beyond words, something holy. Suddenly, I caught sight of a homeless man sitting by me on the pavement, staring at me. His trousers were tied up with string, his shoes held together with tape. His skin had sores and a bumpy rash across his face. I felt a sudden sadness and revulsion. He stank of stale sweat and urine. For a second I thought he spoke to me, but he was just swearing to himself under his breath, fucking this and fucking that. I fished for some change in my bag and gave it to him. Then I walked home, back up the hill, slowly, step by step. It seemed much steeper now. It took forever in the sweltering heat. For some reason, I couldn't stop thinking about the homeless man. Apart from feeling pity, there was another feeling, unnameable somehow, a kind of fear. I pictured him as a baby in his mother's arms. Did she ever imagine her baby would end up crazy, dirty and stinking, huddled on the pavement, muttering obscenities? I thought of my mother. Was she crazy? Is that why she did it? Why she strapped me into the passenger seat of her yellow Mini and sped us towards that red brick wall? I was like that car. It's cheerful canary yellow. The same yellow as in my paint box. Now I hate that colour. Every time I use it, I think of death. Why did she do it? I suppose I'll never know. I used to think it was suicide. Now I think it was attempted murder because I was in the car, too, wasn't I? Sometimes I think I was the intended victim. It was me she was trying to kill, not herself. But that's crazy. Why would she want to kill me? Tears collected in my eyes as I walked up the hill. I wasn't crying for my mother or myself, or even that poor homeless man. I was crying for all of us. There's so much pain everywhere, and we just close our eyes to it. The truth is we're all scared. We're terrified of each other. I'm terrified of myself and of my mother in me. Is her madness in my blood? Is it? Am I going to... No, stop. Stop. I'm not writing about that. I'm not. 20th of July. Last night, Gabriel and I went out for dinner. We usually do on Fridays.
Date night,
he calls it in a silly American accent. Gabriel always downplays his feelings and makes fun of anything he considers soppy. He likes to think of himself as cynical and unsentimental, but the truth is, he's a deeply romantic man, in his heart, if not his speech. Actions speak louder than words, don't they? And Gabriel's actions make me feel totally loved. Where do you want to go? I asked. Three guesses. Augusto's? Got it in one. Augusto's is our local Italian restaurant just down the road. It's nothing special, but it's our home from home and we've spent many happy evenings there. We went around 8 o'clock. The air conditioning wasn't working, so we sat by the open window in the hot, still, humid air and drank chilled, dry white wine. I felt quite drunk by the end and we laughed a lot. Nothing, really. We kissed outside the restaurant and had sex when we got home. Thankfully, Gabriel has come round to the portable fan, at least when we were in bed. I positioned it in front of us, and we lay in the cool breeze, wrapped in each other's arms. He stroked my hair and kissed me. I love you, he whispered. I didn't say anything, I didn't need to. He knows how I feel. But I ruined the mood, stupidly, clumsily, by asking if he would sit for me. I want to paint you, I said. Again? You already did. That was 4 years ago. I want to paint you again. He didn't look enthusiastic. What kind of thing do you have in mind? I hesitated, and then said it was for the Jesus picture. Gabriel sat up and gave a kind of strangled laugh.
Oh, come on, Alicia.
What?
I don't know about that, love, he said. I don't think so.
Why not?
Why do you think? Painting me on the cross? What are people going to say?
Since when do you care what people say?
I don't, not about most things, but, I mean, they might think that's how you see me.
I laughed. I don't think you're the Son of God, if that's what you mean.
It's just an image. Something that happened organically while I was painting. I haven't consciously thought about it.
Well, maybe you should think about it.
Why? It's not a comment on you or our marriage.
Then what is it?
How should I know?
Gabriel laughed at this and rolled his eyes. All right, he said. Fuck it. If you want, we can try. I suppose you know what you're doing. That doesn't sound like much of an endorsement, but I know Gabriel believes in me and my talent. I'd never be a painter if it weren't for him. If he hadn't needled and encouraged and bullied me, I'd never have kept going during those first few dead years after college, when I was painting walls with Jean-Félix. Before I met Gabriel, I lost my way somehow. I lost myself. I don't miss those druggy partiers who passed for friends during my 20s. I only ever saw them at night. They vanished at dawn like vampires fleeing the light. When I met Gabriel, they faded away into nothing and I didn't even notice. I didn't need them anymore. I didn't need anyone now I had him. He saved me, like Jesus. Maybe that's what the painting is about. Gabriel is my whole world and has been since the day we met. I'll love him no matter what he does or what happens, no matter how much he upsets me, no matter how untidy or messy he is, how thoughtless, how selfish. I'll take him just as he is, until death do us part. 21st of July. Today Gabriel came and sat for me in the studio.
I'm not doing this for days again, he said. How long are we talking about?
It's going to take more than one session to get it right.
Is this just a ploy to spend more time together? If so, how about we skip the preamble and go to bed?
I laughed. Maybe afterwards, if you're good and don't fidget too much. I positioned him standing in front of the fan, his hair blew in the breeze.
How should I look?
He asked, striking a pose. Not like that, just be yourself.
Don't you want me to adopt an anguished expression?
I'm not sure Jesus was anguished. I don't see him like that. Don't pull any faces, just stand there. And don't move.
You're the boss.
He stood for about 20 minutes and then he broke the pose, saying he was tired. Sit down then, I said, but don't talk. I'm working on the face.
Gabriel sat on a chair and kept quiet while I worked.
I enjoyed painting his face. It's a good face. A strong jaw, high cheekbones, elegant nose. Sitting there with the spotlight on him, he looked like a Greek statue, a hero of some kind. But something was wrong. I don't know what. Maybe I was pushing too hard. I just couldn't get the shape of his eyes right, nor the colour. The first thing I ever noticed about Gabriel was the sparkle in his eyes, like a tiny diamond in each iris. But now, for some reason, I couldn't catch it. Maybe I'm just not skilled enough. Or maybe Gabriel has something extra that can't be captured in paint. The eyes remained dead, lifeless. I could feel myself getting annoyed. Fuck, I said. It's not going well.
Time for a break?
Yeah, time for a break.
Shall we have sex?
That made me laugh. Okay. Gabriel jumped up, took hold of me and kissed me. We made love in the studio, there on the floor. The whole time I kept glancing at the lifeless eyes in Gabriel's portrait. They were staring at me, burning into me.
I had to turn away.
But I could still feel them watching.
Chapter 2. I went to find Diomedes to report on my meeting with Alicia. He was in his office, sorting through piles of sheet music. Well, he said, not looking up. How did it go? It didn't, really. Diomedes gave me a quizzical glance and I hesitated. If I'm going to get anywhere with her, I need Alicia to be able to think and feel. Absolutely. And your concern is... It's impossible to get through to someone when they're so heavily medicated. It's like she's 6 feet underwater. Diomedes frowned. I wouldn't go that far, he said. I'm not familiar with the exact dose she's on. I checked with Yuri, 16 milligrams of risperidone, a horse's dose. Diomedes raised an eyebrow. That's certainly quite high, yes. It could probably be reduced. You know, Christian is head of Alicia's care team. You should talk to him about it. I think it'll sound better coming from you. Diomedes gave me a doubtful look. You and Christian knew each other before, didn't you, at Broadmoor? Very slightly. Diomedes didn't respond immediately. He reached over to a little dish of sugared almonds on his desk and offered me one. I shook my head. He popped an almond in his mouth and crunched it, watching me as he chewed. Tell me, he said, is everything friendly between you and Christian? That's an odd question. Why do you ask? Because I'm picking up on some hostility. Not on my part. But on his? You'll have to ask him. I have no problem with Christian. Perhaps I'm imagining it. But I'm sensing something. Keep an eye on it. Any aggression or competitiveness interferes with the work. You two need to work with each other, not against each other. I'm aware of that. Well, Christian needs to be included in this discussion. You want Alicia to feel, yes, but remember, with greater feeling comes greater danger. Danger for whom? For Alicia, of course. Diomedes wagged his finger at me. Don't forget she was highly suicidal when we first brought her here. She made numerous attempts to end her life, and the medication keeps her stable. It keeps her alive. If we lower the dose, there's every chance she will be overwhelmed by her feelings and be unable to cope. Are you prepared to take that risk? I took what Diomedes said very seriously, but I nodded. It's a risk I believe we need to take, Professor, I said. Otherwise, we'll never reach her. Diomedes shrugged. Then I shall talk to Christian on your behalf. Thank you. We'll see how he reacts. Psychiatrists don't often respond well to being told how to medicate their patients.
Of course, I can overrule him, but I don't tend to do that. Let me broach the subject with him subtly. I'll tell you what he says. It might be better not to mention me when you talk to him. I see, he said with a strange smile. Very well, I won't. Diomedes pulled out a little box from his desk, sliding off the cover to reveal a row of cigars. He offered me one. I shook my head. You don't smoke? He seemed surprised. You look like a smoker to me. No, only the occasional cigarette, just now and then. I'm trying to quit. Good for you. He opened the window. You know that joke about why you can't be a therapist and smoke, because it means you're still fucked up? He laughed and popped one of the cigars into his mouth. I think we're all a bit crazy in this place. You know that sign they used to have in the offices? You don't need to be mad to work here, but it helps. Diomedes laughed again. He lit the cigar and puffed on it, blowing the smoke outside. I watched him enviously. Chapter 3. After lunch, I prowled the corridors, looking for an exit. I was intending to sneak outside and have a cigarette, but I was discovered by Indira by the fire escape. She assumed I was lost. Don't worry, Theo, she said, taking my arm. It took me months to get my bearings around here, like a maze with no way out. I still get lost sometimes, and I've been here 10 years. She laughed. Before I could object, she was guiding me upstairs for a cup of tea in the goldfish bowl. I'll put the kettle on. Bloody miserable weather, isn't it? I wish it would just snow and get it over with. Snow is a very powerful imaginative symbol, don't you think? Wipes everything clean. Have you noticed how the patients keep talking about it? Look out for it, it's interesting. And then, to my surprise, she reached into her bag and pulled out a thick slice of cake wrapped in cling film. She thrust it into my hand. Take it. Walnut cake. I made it last night. For you. Oh, thank you. I know it's unorthodox, but I always get better results with difficult patients if I give them a slice of cake in the session. I laughed. I bet you do. Am I a difficult patient? Indira laughed. No, although I find it works just as well on difficult members of staff too, which you're not either, by the way. A little bit of sugar is a great mood enhancer. I used to make cakes for the canteen, but then Stephanie made such a fuss, all this health and safety nonsense about food being brought in from the outside. You'd think I was smuggling in a file. But I still bake, a little, on the sly. My rebellion against the dictator state. Try it. This was not a question, but a command. I took a bite. It was good. Chewy, nutty, sweet. My mouth was full, so I covered it with my hand as I spoke. I think this will definitely put your patients in a good mood. Indira laughed and looked pleased, and I realized why I liked her. She radiated a kind of maternal calm. She reminded me of my old therapist, Ruth. It was hard to imagine her ruffled or upset. I glanced around the room as she made the tea. The nurse's station is always the hub of a psychiatric unit, its heart. Staff flow to and from it, and it is where the ward is run from in a day-to-day sense, at least where all the practical decisions are made. The goldfish bowl was the nurse's nickname for the station, as its walls were made of reinforced glass, meaning staff could keep an eye on the patients in the recreation room, in theory, at least. In practice, the patients hovered restlessly outside, staring in, watching us, so we were the ones under constant observation. It was a small space, not enough chairs, and the chairs that were there were generally occupied by nurses typing up notes. So you mostly stood in the middle of the room or leant awkwardly against a desk, giving the space a crowded feel, no matter how many people were in it. Here you are, love, Indira said, handing me a mug of tea. Thanks. Christian ambled in and nodded at me. He smelled strongly of the peppermint gum he was always chewing. I remembered he used to smoke heavily when we were at Broadmoor together. It was one of the few things we had in common. Since then, Christian had quit, got married, and had a baby daughter. I wondered what kind of father he made. He didn't strike me as particularly compassionate. He gave me a cold smile. Funny seeing you again like this, Theo. Small world.
In mental health terms, it is, yes. Christian said this as if to imply there were other, larger worlds in which he might be found. I tried to imagine what they might be. To be honest, I could only really imagine him in the gym or in a scrum on the rugby field. Christian stared at me for a few seconds. I'd forgotten his habit of pausing, often lengthily, making you wait while he considered his response. It irritated me here just as much as it had done at Broadmoor. "You're joining the team at a rather unfortunate moment," he said eventually. "The sword of Damocles is hanging over the grove." "You think it's as bad as that?" "It's only a matter of time. The trust is bound to shut us down sooner or later. So, the question is, what are you doing here?"
"What do you mean?"
"Well, rats desert a sinking ship. They don't clamber on board." I was startled by Christian's undisguised aggression. I decided not to rise to the bait. I shrugged. "Possibly," I said, "but I'm not a rat." Before Christian could reply, a massive thud made us jump. Elif was on the other side of the glass, hammering at it with her fists. Her face was pressed up against it, squashing her nose, distorting her features, making her almost monstrous.
"I won't take this shit no more. I hate this. These fucking pills, man."
Christian opened a small hatch in the glass and spoke through it. "Now is not the time to discuss this, Elif.
I'm telling you, I'm not taking them no more. They make me fucking sick."
"I'm not having this conversation now. Make an appointment to see me. Step away, please." Elif scowled, deliberating for a moment. Then she turned and lumbered off, leaving a faint circle of condensation where her nose had been pressed against the glass. "Quite a character," I said. Christian grunted.
"Difficult."
Indira nodded.
"Poor Elif.
What's she in for?"
"Double murder," Christian said. "Killed her mother and her sister, suffocated them while they slept."
I peered through the glass. Elif joined the other patients. She towered over them. One of them slipped some money into her hand, which she pocketed. Then I noticed Alicia at the far end of the room, sitting by herself, by the window, looking out. I watched her for a moment. Christian followed my gaze.
"By the way," he said, "I've been talking to Professor Diomedes about Alicia. I want to see how she does on a lower dose of risperidone. I've brought her down to 5 milligrams.
"I see.
I thought you might want to know, since I heard you saw her for a session."
"Yes."
"We'll have to monitor her closely to see how she reacts to the change. And, by the way, next time you have a problem with how I medicate my patients, come to me directly. Don't sneak off to Diomedes behind my back."
He glared at me as he said this. I smiled back at him.
"I didn't sneak anywhere. I have no problem talking to you directly, Christian."
There was an uncomfortable pause. Christian nodded to himself, as if he'd made his mind up about something.
"You do realize Alicia is borderline. She won't respond to therapy. You're wasting your time."
"How do you know she's borderline?" I said. "If she can't talk."
"Won't talk.
You think she's faking?"
"Yes, as a matter of fact, I do."
"If she's faking, then how can she be borderline?" Christian looked irritated. Indira interrupted before he could reply.
"With all due respect, I don't feel umbrella terms like borderline are particularly helpful. They don't tell us anything very useful at all."
She glanced at Christian.
"This is a subject Christian and I disagree on frequently."
"And how do you feel about Alicia?" I asked her. Indira pondered the question for a moment.
"I find myself feeling very maternal towards her. That's my countertransference. That's what she brings out in me. I feel she needs someone to take care of her."
Indira smiled at me.
"And now she has someone. She has you."
Christian laughed that annoying laugh of his. "Forgive me for being so dense, but how can Alicia benefit from therapy if she doesn't talk?"
"Therapy isn't just about talking," Indira said. "It's about providing a safe space, a containing environment. Most communication is non-verbal, as I'm sure you know."
Christian rolled his eyes at me.
"Good luck, mate," he said. "You'll need it."
Chapter 4. Hello, Alicia, I said. Only a few days had passed since her medication had been lowered, but the difference in Alicia was already apparent. She seemed more fluid in her movements. Her eyes were clearer. The foggy gaze had gone. She seemed like a different person. She stood at the door with Yuri and hesitated. She stared at me, as if seeing me clearly for the first time, taking me in, sizing me up. I wondered what conclusion she was reaching. Evidently, she judged it safe to proceed and walked inside. Without being asked, she sat down. I nodded at Yuri to go. He deliberated for a second, then shut the door behind him. I sat opposite Alicia. There was silence for a moment, just the restless sound of the rain outside, raindrops drumming against the window. Eventually, I spoke. How are you feeling? I asked. No response. Alicia stared at me, eyes like lamps, unblinking. I opened my mouth and closed it again. I was determined to resist the urge to fill the void by talking. Instead, by remaining silent and just sitting there, I hoped to communicate something else, something of a non-verbal nature, that it was okay for us to sit together like this, that I wouldn't hurt her, that she could trust me. If I were to have any success at getting Alicia to talk, I needed to win her trust, and this would take time. Nothing would be accomplished overnight. It would move slowly, like a glacier. But it would move. As we sat there in silence, my head started to throb at the temples, the beginnings of a headache. A telltale symptom, I thought of Ruth, who used to say, in order to be a good therapist, you must be receptive to your patient's feelings, but you must not hold onto them. They are not yours. They do not belong to you. In other words, this thump, thump, thumping in my head wasn't my pain. It belonged to Alicia. And this sudden wave of sadness, this desire to die, 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 did not belong to me either. It was hers, all hers. I sat there, feeling it for her, my head pounding, my stomach churning, for what seemed like hours. Eventually, the 50 minutes were up. I looked at my watch. We have to finish now, I said. Alicia lowered her head and stared at her lap. I hesitated. I lost control of my reserve. I lowered my voice and spoke from the heart. I want to help you, Alicia. I need you to believe that. The truth is, I want to help you to see clearly. At this, Alicia looked up. She stared at me, right through me. You can't help me, her eyes shouted. Look at you, you can barely help yourself. You pretend to know so much and be so wise, but you should be sitting here instead of me, freak, fraud, liar, liar. As she stared at me, I became aware of what had been troubling me the whole session. It's hard to put into words, but a psychotherapist quickly becomes attuned to recognizing mental distress. From physical behavior and speech and a glint in the eyes, something haunted, afraid, mad. And that's what bothered me. Despite the years of medication, despite everything she had done and endured, Alicia's blue eyes remained as clear and cloudless as a summer's day. She wasn't mad. So what was she? What was the expression in her eyes? What was the right word? It was... Before I could finish the thought, Alicia leapt from the chair. She threw herself towards me, hands outstretched like claws. I had no time to move or get out of the way. She landed on top of me, knocking me off balance. We fell to the floor. The back of my head hit the wall with a thud. She bashed my head against the wall again and again and started scratching, slapping, clawing. It took all my strength to throw her off. I scrambled along the floor and reached up to the table. I groped for the attack alarm. Just as my fingers grasped it, Alicia jumped on me and knocked the alarm from my hand. Alicia! Her fingers were tight around my neck, gripping, choking. I groped for the alarm but couldn't reach it. Her hands dug deeper. I couldn't breathe. I made another lunge. This time I managed to grab hold of it. I pressed the alarm. A wailing scream instantly filled my ears, deafening me. I could hear the distant sound of a door opening and Yuri calling for backup. Alicia was dragged off me, releasing her chokehold, and I gasped for breath. It took four nurses to hold Alicia down. She writhed and kicked and fought like a creature possessed. She didn't seem human, more like a wild animal, something monstrous. Christian appeared and sedated her. She lost consciousness. At last, there was silence. Chapter 5. This will sting a bit. Yuri was tending to my bleeding scratches in the goldfish bowl. He opened the bottle of antiseptic and applied it to a swab. The medicinal odour transported me to the sick bay at school, conjuring up memories of playground battle scars, grazed knees and scratched elbows. I remembered the warm, cosy feeling of being taken care of by Matron, bandaged and rewarded for my bravery with a boiled sweet. Then the sting of the antiseptic on my skin brought me back sharply to the present, where the injuries I presented were not so easily remedied. I winced. My head feels like she hit me with a fucking hammer. It's a nasty bruise. You'll have a lump tomorrow. We'd better keep an eye on it. Yuri shook his head. I never should have left you alone with her. I didn't give you a choice. He grunted. That's true enough. Thanks for not saying I told you so. It's noted and appreciated. Yuri shrugged. I don't need to, mate. The professor will say it for me. He's asked to see you in his office. Ah, rather you than me by the look of him. I started getting up. Yuri watched me carefully. Don't rush. Take a minute. Make sure you're ready. Any dizziness or headaches, let me know. I'm fine, honestly. That wasn't strictly true, but I didn't feel as bad as I looked. Bloody scratches and black bruises around my throat where she'd tried to strangle me. She'd dug so deep with her fingers she'd drawn blood. I knocked on the professor's door. Diomedes' eyes widened when he saw me. He tutted. Oh, Bob. Bod, did you need stitches? No, of course not, I'm fine. Diomedes gave me a disbelieving look and ushered me inside. Come in, Theo, sit down. The others were already there. Christian and Stephanie were standing. Indira was sitting by the window. It felt like a formal reception, and I wondered if I were about to get fired. Diomedes sat behind his desk. He gestured for me to sit in the remaining empty chair. I sat. He stared at me in silence for a moment, drumming his fingers, deliberating what to say or how to say it, but before he could make up his mind, he was beaten to it by Stephanie. "This is an unfortunate incident," she said. "Extremely unfortunate." She turned to me. "Obviously we're all relieved you're still in one piece, but that doesn't alter the fact it raises all kinds of questions. And the first is, what were you doing alone with Alicia?" "It was my fault," I said. "I asked Yuri to leave. I take full responsibility." "On whose authority did you make that decision? If either of you had been seriously injured..." Diomedes interrupted. "Please don't let's get dramatic. Thankfully, neither was hurt." He gestured at me dismissively. "A few scratches are hardly grounds for a court-martial." Stephanie pulled a face. "I don't think jokes are really appropriate, Professor. I really don't." "Who's joking?" Diomedes said, turning to me. "I'm deadly serious. Tell us, Theo, what happened?" I felt all their eyes on me. I addressed myself to Diomedes. I chose my words carefully. "Well, she attacked me," I said. "That's what happened." "That much is obvious, but why? I take it was unprovoked." "Yes, at least consciously." "And unconsciously?" "Well, obviously, Alicia was reacting to me on some level. I believe it shows us how much she wants to communicate." Christian laughed.
"You call that communication?"
"Yes, I do," I said. "Rage is a powerful communication. The other patients, the zombies who just sit there, vacant, empty, they've given up. Alicia hasn't. Her attack tells us something she can't articulate directly about her pain, her desperation, her anguish. She was telling me not to give up on her, not yet. Christian rolled his eyes. A less poetic interpretation might be that she was off her meds and out of her mind. He turned to Diomedes. I told you this would happen, Professor. I warned you about lowering the dose. Really, Christian? I said. I thought it was your idea. Christian dismissed me with a roll of his eyes. He was a psychiatrist through and through, I thought, and by that I mean psychiatrists tend to be wary of psychodynamic thinking. They favour a more biological, chemical, and above all, practical approach, like the cup of pills Alicia was handed at every meal. There was nothing Christian's unfriendly, narrow gaze told me that I could contribute. Diomedes, however, eyed me more thoughtfully.
It hasn't put you off, Theo, he said. What happened?
I shook my head. On the contrary, I'm encouraged. Diomedes nodded, looking pleased.
Good. I agree. Such an intense reaction to you is certainly worth investigating. I think you should keep going.
At this, Stephanie could restrain herself no longer.
That's absolutely out of the question.
Diomedes kept talking as if she hadn't spoken. He kept looking at me.
You think you can get her to talk?
Before I could reply, a voice spoke behind me. I believe he can, yes. It was Indira. I'd almost forgotten she was there. I turned round. And in a way, Indira said, Alicia has begun to talk. She's communicating through Theo. He is her advocate. It's already happening. Diomedes nodded. He looked pensive for a moment. I knew what was on his mind. Alicia Berenson was a famous patient and a powerful bargaining tool with the Trust. If we were able to make demonstrable progress with her, we'd have a much stronger hand in saving the Grove from closure.
How long to see results? Diomedes asked.
I can't answer that, I said. You know that as well as I do. It takes as long as it takes. 6 months, a year, probably longer. It could be years.
You have 6 weeks.
Stephanie drew herself up and crossed her arms. I am the manager of this unit, and I simply cannot allow...
I am clinical director of the Grove, interrupted Diomedes. This is my decision, not yours. I take full responsibility for any injuries incurred upon our long-suffering therapist here.
He winked at me as he said this. Stephanie didn't say anything further. She glared at Diomedes, then at me. She turned and walked out.
Oh dear, Diomedes said. You appear to have made an enemy of Stephanie. How unfortunate.
He shared a smile with Indira and then gave me a serious look.
6 weeks, under my supervision. Understand?
I agreed, of course. I had no choice but to agree.
6 weeks, I said.
Good. Christian stood up, visibly annoyed.
Alicia won't talk in 6 weeks or 60 years, he said. You're wasting your time.
He walked out. I wondered why Christian was so positive I would fail. But it made me even more determined to succeed.